And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday edition. Well, Bonnie, today we visit with NYU marketing professor Adam Alter. You may be surprised by his read on human judgment and decision-making. He's the author of Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave, and he joins us by phone from New York City. Welcome to you, Adam Alter.
Adam?
Hi.
Hi.
There he is.
There you are. Okay. How are you?
Well, thank you. How are you? Sorry, I missed the introduction there.
No,
can you
no,
speak
that's
up
okay.
A little bit? A little soft on the phone. There we go.
Yeah. No, that's fine. So let's start with the title of your book because it's, you know, what is Drunk Tank Pink and how does it work on our behavior?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. It's obviously an unusual title and people have a lot of questions. It's the name of a color, and it's a color that psychologists stumbled on in the late 60s, and they were trying to work out how they could paint the inside of classrooms to encourage students to behave better. And they found that of all the colors they tried, this very bright, bubblegummy, Pepto-Bismol kind of pink color seemed to do the best job. And they were surprised by this. They did a number of other tests to see whether the color was effective in other areas. And one thing they found was that it was very effective in jail cells, that if you took very aggressive prisoners and put them inside a pink-colored cell for about 10 or 15 minutes, the prisoner was much more compliant and much better behaved. So it got the name Drunk Tank Pink because colloquially a lot of people refer to these jail cells as drunk tanks. And it's been used very widely since then. Some football coaches have even painted the visiting locker rooms this bright pink color because they think that it'll calm down their opposition at halftime and they'll have a better chance of winning the game.
So is that psychological or physiological? Why do we react to it that way?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and we're not totally sure. You know, there are a couple of options. One is, as you say, psychological, that we associate this color pink perhaps with femininity and perhaps being slightly more gentle than some of these aggressive males are used to being. Another alternative is that it's something physiological, and some of the proponents of this color and its use in these spheres suggest exactly that. They suggest that even if you're colorblind, if you look at this color not knowing that it's pink, you see similar effects. So there's something about this particular wavelength as it hits your eye that has these effects. I'm skeptical about that. I'm colorblind, so I'm pretty sensitive to that argument, and I'm not sure that that's true. I think it's probably more psychological, more based on the association than anything.
How about studies of the impact of sport uniform colors like the Oakland Raiders black and the Miami Heat tend to use red or black on the road? Is
yeah,
it more intimidating?
Yes, it is. It is intimidating. It also leads you to be called for more penalties. There's some research looking at what happens when a team changes its uniform from one that doesn't have much black to one that's predominantly black. Or when a team, as you say, they may have an away uniform or a home uniform that has more black than the other uniform they normally wear. And you do find that these teams are called for more penalties. They are perceived to be more aggressive. And they can also have positive effects. It's obviously beneficial to be seen as dominant and aggressive in a lot of sports. But at the same time, the downside is that you are called for more penalties.
Yeah, I remember reading, come to think of it, that red cars got more speeding tickets or more tickets in general.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, no, that is. I've heard that as well. And I think it's about these preconceived ideas we have with the color pink, with the color black, with the color red in sports cars. We assume that the person is driving quicker. They're trying to show something about their preferences. And perhaps we then make assumptions about what kind of person is driving the car. So there is some research showing exactly that.
Well, we did this show on love yesterday, Modern Love, with a columnist of the Modern Love column in the New York Times. And you talk about when this online dating stuff, when you wear red blouses or shirts, that actually has an effect.
Yeah, it's a striking effect, actually. And it's quite a big one, a lot bigger than a lot of similar effects in the social sciences broadly. And what we find and what people who run these studies find is that if you wear red, say you have a picture of yourself on some dating website, for 2 months you wear a red shirt, and then you use exactly the same photo, but you digitally alter the shirt so that instead of red, this time it's black or blue or green or yellow or white. You keep cycling through these colors. What you find is the same person in the same photo with the same profile will get many more hits when they're wearing that red shirt, even though everything else stays the same. So red really does seem to make us more attractive.
Hmm.
let's switch off a little bit and discuss first names and how someone named Kim or Kelly or Ken are more likely to donate to Hurricane Katrina victims.
Yeah, it's
the K's rule.
That's right. It's a staggering effect. And the basic idea there is that as humans are, we tend to be pretty self-focused. And so anything that reminds us of ourselves, we find more appealing, more attractive, and more interesting, more attention-getting. So one thing you can do is if you show people a list of all the letters in the alphabet, you ask them the strange question to think about their five favorite letters. You know, it's an unusual question that we're not often asked. What you find is that almost everyone will pick at least one of the letters that begins their first name or their surname. And so we pay a lot of attention to and quite like letters that remind us of our own names. What you find then when you apply this is that since we also name other things like hurricanes, when there's a relief fund that's designed to help the victims after these storms pass through, you get a jump in donations from people who happen to have that same initial. So as you said, Kim or a Kelly or a Kevin will donate more to Hurricane Katrina than to, say, Rita, which begins with a different letter. And it's a strong effect. And over the course of about a dozen years, I ran some analyses. And just by changing the names of the hurricanes, instead of going down a list alphabetically without paying much attention to demographics, if we focus more on names that begin with J or M, which are the two most common letters that begin first names in the U.S., you could probably attract $100 million, perhaps even more, in aid just by tweaking the names of these hurricanes.
Well, have you spoken to the NOAA,
the National Hurricane Center?
Yeah, I haven't. I've spoken a little bit to them. I've spoken on the Weather Channel about this a little bit as well. We haven't got much traction so far, but I'm going to keep trying because I think it's an interesting idea. There are other factors to take into account before making it a practical recommendation, but I think there's something to the idea, and it's completely inexpensive, which is the best kind of intervention.
Well, you talk more about names. I mean, not just the names of storms, but our own names, the names of lawyers, stocks, and you talk about this implicit egotism. I guess that's where the, if the storm starts with a K and your name starts with a K, you're more likely to donate. But it seems like names have a really big subconscious impact. So can you talk about it more?
Yeah, names do a lot of things. There is this link with the first initial, and that's a very powerful effect. That is that implicit egotism idea that you mentioned. But we also know that there are other effects. One effect is based on the fluency or the pronounceability of the name. So names obviously vary according to how easily we can pronounce them. If you imagine you're presenting an award at an award ceremony, you pull the envelope out and there's a name in front of you. The way we can judge fluency is by how much anxiety you have when you see that name pop up in front of you. Some names are really easy to pronounce and some are much harder to pronounce.
How about alphabet and, say, spouses? Would Bonnie be more attractive to a Benjamin?
You know, people have published research on that, but there's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania at the Wharton School who has shown that a lot of those effects are actually spurious. They're not real effects. They're driven by other factors. So I think the implicit egotism idea goes reasonably far. I think the hurricane idea, there's something to that because we're certainly attracted to the initials of our name. But a lot of the effects, for example, showing that Larrys are more likely to become lawyers, Erics are more likely to become engineers, there's some suggestion that there are other factors that drive those outcomes that are not related just to the names being similar. So some of that research, I think, is a little bit shaky, but some of it is, I think, quite solid.
Well, you touched on the fluency, and disfluency and fluency are a part of all this. Would you explain that a little more for us?
Yeah, sure. So fluency, as I said, is the simplicity of the name. Disfluency, a disfluent name is one that's hard to pronounce, and that matters in all sorts of different domains. We did some analyses looking at the performance of lawyers at law firms, and our question was, how long does it take after you graduate from law school to become a partner in the law firm that you happen to be in? And when we fixed all sorts of other factors, like if we only pay attention to white American males, so we remove any questions of ethnic bias or racial bias or nationality bias, what you find is that in the middle part of their careers, so starting from about the sixth or seventh year of their careers till roughly the 16th year, you find that there's about a 10% bonus, a 10% greater likelihood for people with very simple names to have become partners rather than those with complex names. So there's something that's going on. There's some dynamic when you join a law firm. If you happen to have a simple name, You're more likely perhaps to be chosen for committees and teams. People are less anxious when pronouncing your name. Hmm. So that's quite a big effect, much bigger than you'd think there would be from just something as simple as a name.
So maybe you would recommend that some people change their names.
Yeah, that's an extreme recommendation, and right. people balk at that, which you can understand. I mean, names mean a lot to people, and they're very attached to them. But there are other ways around that. If you think about the name Barack Obama, when we first saw that name, for a lot of us, that was a foreign name. It was a name that we hadn't seen before. And now it's one of the most fluent and familiar names around because it's used so often. So the key, if you're entering a new workplace and you have a name that's disfluent, there are a lot of things you can do. You can use your name often, more often than perhaps other people might naturally do. You can give people a mnemonic or a rhyme that helps them pronounce it so they can remember, oh, that's right, this person's name happens to rhyme with some other word. You know, just help people out and make sure that if you're going to give them a nickname, make it as simple as possible. There's a lot you can do to enhance the fluency of your own name.
Well, we're speaking with Adam Alter. He's an assistant professor of marketing at NYU School of Business and an affiliate.
He's got A in both first and second.
Yes, he does. And he has an affiliated appointment. There's another AA at the psychology department at NYU. And an author. His latest book is Drunk Tank Pink. And we're going to take a short break. We'll come back and take some calls.
South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center presents two nights of Music Masters. New flamenco guitarist Jesse Cook brings his blue guitar tour to Miami on Friday, April 4th. And salsa legend Poncho Sanchez and his Latin jazz band perform Olé Coltrane with special guest James Carter on Saturday, April 5th. More information at smdcac.org or 786-573-5300. Roses are red. Palm fronds are green. What place in South Florida is the most compelling you've seen? WLRN and the O Miami Poetry Festival are celebrating National Poetry Month in April with the Poetry Contest About South Florida. Include the line, "This is where," in your poem. Submit your poem at WLRN.org.
And 19 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Adam Alter. We're talking about his book, Drunk Tank Pink. If you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Adam, how about the ebb and flow of first name popularities? You talk about in your book that today nobody wants to be named Adolf or Ebenezer. What's with that flow and those changes?
Yeah, when you have one very prominent person with a name that's either very an appealing person or a very unappealing person, you see thereafter for decades, sometimes centuries to come, the pattern of naming changes pretty dramatically. So obviously in the case of Adolf, in the 1940s, there was a stark drop in the popularity of that name. The name Ebenezer, Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge, was popular. People started to use the name much less often. It was quite popular until that time. When the TV show Beverly Hills 90210 came on air, saw a massive rise in the use of those names, not just in the United States, but also in parts of Europe. So in France, names like Kelly were almost unheard of until the early 90s, when there was a very sharp rise in that name because this one character was very prominent and popular.
You know, we've been talking mostly about the rather harmless ways that we're affected by these nine unexpected forces, you know, that shape how we are and how we think. But there's some more insidious ones. You talk about this unconscious stereotyping and especially how it causes impaired judgment and is dangerous in our legal system and the ability for some people to have a fair trial. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there's some very disturbing research looking at what happens in death penalty trials, for example, where a death penalty is on offer because the crime is a very major crime. And if the victim is white and the perpetrator is black, the person who happens to look more stereotypically black, and by that the researchers mean they have particular facial features that we associate more strongly with black faces rather than white faces, that person is dramatically more likely to get the death penalty, even if the crime is identical. So your facial features, as they're tied to your ethnicity or your race, can play a very strong role in your outcomes in the legal system, which is a staggering and obviously very disturbing finding.
Yeah. So what kind of, do you have any solutions for this other than, that the legal system become aware of this, people become aware of this? What do you propose?
Well, this is really difficult, right? Some of these problems have very obvious solutions, and others like this one, I think, are intractable or very difficult to solve. I think awareness is a good thing. Education is always useful. In this case, though, it's not totally clear what you would do in each individual case. You know, you could tell the jury, just please be aware of this fact, tell them about the research, explain that there's this relationship, but it's not clear exactly how, on a case-by-case basis, you use that information.
Right.
How do you discount the facial features? It's very hard to do. But I do think education goes some way, so that people can at least do their best to try, and we know they're not very good at this, but to try to unbias themselves, if at all possible.
Is there sort of an evolutionary aspect to this kind of profiling, that eons and eons and eons we found that if we saw somebody who was different than us, that we would be distrustful of them because they could threaten our group and our lives?
Yeah, that's right. I think much of it is based in difference, and xenophobia, the fear of difference, is a very powerful human instinct. It starts quite young, and it's something that's very difficult to eradicate completely, and so it is one of those problems that I mentioned in the book that is very difficult to solve. There are some ways to do that. People sometimes talk about whether we could have trials conducted without showing the face of the defendant, but of course that then makes it very hard for the defendant to make his or her case and for the jury to perceive the facial expression, the nonverbal expressions that are very important in judging guilt, for example.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a sticky situation because there really isn't any solution. Except for every person to become more aware of these unconscious biases.
Right.
How about the association of names and wealth?
Yeah.
You touch on that.
Yeah, there is some research looking at this that, as you probably wouldn't be surprised to hear, some names are just generally chosen by wealthier people. They tend to be foreign-sounding names, often European-sounding names, perhaps French names. Very popular among wealthier people, and other names are more popular among the poorer groups in the population. And what happens then is when you meet someone and you know very little about them, their name conveys that information because you've formed that association over time. So if you happen to get a job application from someone and they have the name, say, Amelie or Elizabeth, some name that is associated with wealthier people, you make certain assumptions automatically about that person. If you get an application with the name Bobby or Billy.
Billy Bob.
Or Billy Bob, put them together.
Billy Joe.
Exactly. Those are names you'd assume there's something else about that person, that they're probably a little bit poorer, perhaps not as well educated, because the demographics suggest as much. And so it's important to keep that in mind when you're choosing names for children.
Even though they may own an oil well.
Yeah, they may own an oil well. Yeah, it just depends what you want to convey, I guess.
You mentioned about French just now, choosing a French name, but tell us about that French adventurer, Michel Siffre, and the effects of extended social isolation on us.
Yeah, Siffre was a fascinating guy. He decided that he wanted to help in the space race. So this was in the 50s and 60s, and it was very hard for a lot of people to contribute, but he was an adventurer, and he more than anything wanted to contribute to this big question about how humans would handle being in space for extended periods of time. And one of the factors that people were very concerned about was that you'd be far away from other humans. And they didn't know much about what the consequences would be, because we're all, even in the 50s and 60s, we were all so often exposed to other people through the media and just by interacting with them. So Siffre decided that he would go into a cave. He did this a number of times, and he would live on his own. He would have minimal stimulation from magazines, and he would have all the food he needed, but he would live in isolation. And he reported, you know, he was very excited about the prospect of doing this, but he reported that quite quickly he became very depressed, and he sort of lost his bearings. He started to hallucinate. He wasn't sure what was real and what wasn't real. He befriended a mouse, and then he described how, unfortunately, he accidentally killed the mouse, and how it was one of the most devastating experiences of his life. And It gives you a sense of just how powerful social isolation can be, and some people experience it more acutely than others, but depriving people of that in say, the prison system when we isolate prisoners right. is really a form of torture.
Mm.
So 20 years on death row, of course, is going to certainly affect your mind.
Certainly, yeah. I don't weigh very heavily on whether isolation in the prison system should ever be used, but I think we are not good at intuitively recognizing just how powerful a form of punishment it is. You know, we're very sensitive to the idea of physical punishment. We know that breaking bones is both painful and has lasting consequences. But we also have this sense that a lot of forms of psychological torture, like social isolation, mm-hmm. will wear off quickly, and that they're not that severe. But they actually are much more severe and have long-term consequences, much longer than we imagine.
Touch on the psychology behind bystander non-intervention, where if we're in a group, we're less likely to react to violence against another person.
Yeah, this is one of the most famous studies in the history of social psychology, and actually my advisor at Princeton when I was a graduate student was responsible for conducting those studies in the 60s. There was a very famous case of a young woman in New York City in Queens who was murdered, unfortunately, in front of a crowd, and the crowd was in an apartment building and their windows faced onto the area on the street where she happened to be murdered. And the original claim from journalists in the New York Times and elsewhere was that this suggested something about the callousness of New Yorkers, that there was something wrong with New York City and that made these people callous. And my advisor, John Daly, and his collaborator, Bib Latané, decided that that didn't sound right to them, that it must be something about the situation that encouraged these people not to act. And what they did was they ran a series of studies where they exposed people to fake emergencies and things like you see someone who's lying injured on the ground, or you're in a room and artificial smoke is pumped out through a door, which suggests there might be a fire. And what you find is that when people are on their own, they act very quickly. They're very sure of themselves. They know that if they don't do something, no one else will, and so they act very fast. If you're in a group, though, we have this tendency to stay cool, calm, and collected, and there's a virtue in doing that. We're really embarrassed about the idea that we might think something is an emergency when no one else does. And so what you see is these people glance at each other sideways, and they're trying to work out, does this other person think this is an emergency as well? And if the other person doesn't act because they're playing that same game of chicken, you end up sort of assuming that maybe I've misinterpreted. And often it'll take people a lot longer to act. They need to coordinate their action. And so it's you do get this tendency for bigger groups to act less often and less quickly than just isolated individuals.
You know, we have about a few minutes left. I think where this brings me, which was one of your more disturbing observations, is that we're not a single person, just even talking about how we react in crowds versus alone, but that we change according to so many factors around us that just kind of fly under the radar, and that we can't know who we are unless we know what's affecting us and how.
Yeah, that's the big conclusion for me from this book, and it's something that's driven a lot of my research in the last decade or so. And I think it's exactly right that you can ask people, how generous are you, how open-minded are you, how warm are you, how friendly are you? And I think we all have the sense that there is a right answer to that question, that we have a personality that is at least to some extent consistent. But this research shows that situations matter a tremendous amount, and even though you may feel you are a, say, 7 out of 10 on some generosity scale, there are many circumstances where you will be much less generous and others where you'll be more generous. And so our personalities are really about a range on every dimension rather than about a fixed point. And that range is pretty large. It's pretty wide. We've shown in a lot of research.
Do you think that it's a bad thing that we don't know about them? I mean, if we knew about all the things affecting our behavior, couldn't we be stricken, you know, by just, I mean, paralyzed by just knowing too much?
Yeah, I think so. People often ask whether I pay attention to all of these factors at all times, and I don't think you can, and I don't think you'd be better off doing that. But there are some major decisions we make in life. Imagine you're a juror on a trial, or you're naming your child, or naming a business. You know, these are big decisions. We make them infrequently, and when we do, it's worth knowing what factors are going to be influencing us. So I think most of the time, online, in everyday life, as you're walking around, you don't need to keep these ideas in mind. But when you're making a big, very important decision, it's worth knowing what factors are driving and shaping your behavior.
Well, it's been interesting, at least, and thought-provoking to speak with Adam Alter. He's an assistant professor of marketing at NYU's Stern School of Business with an affiliated appointment at the psychology department at NYU, and an author. And we'll have links to his website, adamalterauthor.com, and his latest book, Drunk Tank Pink and Other Unexpected Forces That Shape How We Think, Feel, and Behave, on our website and on our Facebook page. Thank you, Adam Alter.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Food and Dining up next.
Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Tune in for Monday's Topical Currents when we present an At Your Service program about elder care. We'll visit with journalist Virginia Morris, who's written a comprehensive book, How to Care for Aging Parents. She deals with medical, financial, housing, and emotional issues, and how to prepare for inevitable loss. Tune in, phone in for Topical Currents, Monday at 1 o'clock. Join us Monday for the next edition of Topical Currents. We're funded by listeners like you and by Air Como. Does your business use compressed air or vacuum? Air Como's professionals have been servicing the compressed air and vacuum requirements of businesses in South Florida for over 15 years. More information at aircomo.com.
Next time on The World, a 90-year-old grandfather has become a superstar sex columnist. He's India's expert for the curious and the sexually confused.
Dear Dr. Vatsa, is there any chance I can get pregnant from watching a porn film?
Dear reader, but where will the men go if videos do the trick?
No question is too embarrassing for India's Dr. Vatsa. His story on The World.
Join us at 3 p.m. for the next edition of The World here on 91.3 WLRN.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Of course, it's Food and Dining Thursday. My friend Linda Gastenheimer, she's a Cordon Bleu chef, author, and syndicated columnist. And she's here with us. Her topic is spring entertaining. Linda, I was thinking at my house I should be entertaining more spring cleaning, but...
That's probably true. I can believe that, Joe. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello. Good afternoon.
But you know something? I really love spring. It's one of the nicest times of the year. The weather is delightful. I mean, just look at it. It's just perfect now. It's just perfect weather this time of year. The winter events start to slow down. It's a great time to have friends in. But no one wants to spend days prepping, getting ready for having friends in. And it's also time of year when people are planning bigger parties, showers or weddings. So our guests are here to help us on both counts, parties and weddings. Thierry Isambert, he's the chef owner of Thierry's Catering and Event Planning. So welcome, Thierry.
Thank you, Linda. Good afternoon.
You can see he's very French. You'll hear more about that. Also here is Peter Key. He's an event planner for Thierry's. Welcome, Peter Key.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Great to have you both here. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for our guests? Are you planning a wedding or other large party? Or do you just want some advice about some smaller parties? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Email is radio@WLRN.org.
And the phones are open now, so give us a call. Also, of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read his wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
The wines of spring. That's what I'm going to talk about.
I guess you'd like to have some spring up there in Michigan.
Well, we're down to a couple feet of snow, so we're getting there.
All right, good. All right. Let's talk about friends for dinner. So what are some ideas about having people over without spending all day in the kitchen? Thierry, or
takeouts?
Well, takeouts are a great way to go, definitely. During spring particularly, it's wonderful to choose a venue that has both indoor and outdoor amenities. Whether it's at your home and you have a nice veranda that you could use, it's a wonderful opportunity to bask in the weather that South Florida offers right now.
So maybe barbecue make things easier.
Definitely.
Perhaps you could get yourself ready in advance with a barbecue, maybe parboiling some meats or something so they won't take so long.
By all means. Also, the usage of fresh vegetables at this time is wonderful. People love to see fresh greens, carrots, just wonderful, healthy, crisp things, which are very easy to hold and pre-make.
Right. Somebody told me that you could buy all these greens, wrap them in a dish towel or something and make it a little bit moist, and then it'll hold in your refrigerator for days.
Best way to store it, some say.
In the crisper, even for weeks.
Yeah, absolutely correct, yeah.
Yes, I'm correct, thank you.
Wait, you just wrap them in a dish towel, you're saying?
A wet one.
A wet one?
A wet one.
Damp, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
Like a damp paper towel.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I found that even with fresh herbs, I would wash them, dry them, and I wrap a wet paper towel around the end and put it in a plastic bag and put it in the crisper.
It lasts longer.
Yes.
It lasts longer. Nowadays, we're all looking for that, definitely.
And you know, you're talking about easy things for prepping for parties. I mean, you talk about all these beautiful fruits and vegetables and all. Maybe just use those as a centerpiece.
By all means.
A basket
By
of
By all
that.
Means.
Right. Okay. So also setting up a party, having friends in, creating a mood. You know, when you greet people at the door and all, they're all ready for a party because you've created this mood. Do you have any ideas, some suggestions?
Definitely. Creating a mood in an event is simple. Guests, when they arrive at your house, want to feel like if they're personally invited. They want to feel part of it. Great ways to do this are setting up maybe little mason jars with the place card tied around it with a nice little recipe for a spring cocktail or a spring beverage. Immediately as they walk in, they already feel like part of the ambience. They feel like part of the event, and they're personally involved.
That's a great idea. Right. And maybe when you've invited them. Most people now are invited out over the internet anyway by email.
Right.
You know, give that kind of idea
exactly.
of what's happening. Terry, Absolutely. Did you have something to say?
Yeah, and I think also we should have some food that compliment the guests when they enter the house. You know, greet them with some food, some hors d'oeuvre, amuse-bouche, you know, and that's to put them in the mood.
Right. Immediately. Feed
immediately,
and drink.
Immediately.
As soon as they walk
Absolutely.
In. So what would be an hors d'oeuvre, an easy, simple hors d'oeuvre to make if we were going to make one? Do you have an idea?
Yeah, we could do like a shrimp scampi. You know, people love shrimps, you know. It's a hot shrimp. It's a beautiful hors d'oeuvre that we do and that will work. Also some mini leeks and Saint-André fondue.
No, it's wonderful.
Very comfortable.
I made that the other night.
Yeah, right. When you said mini leeks with...
Saint-André cheese, yeah.
With a cheese fondue.
With a cheese fondue, yeah.
I never heard of doing that. First of all, it's very hard to find a mini leek. First of all, some people don't even know what a leek is. Food-wise, that is.
Where do you find mini leeks?
No, yes. The mini leeks like scallions. You know,
it's
part of the onions family.
And the Saint-André cheese?
And the Saint-André cheese from Canada.
So you just melt the cheese?
Yeah,
and
melt
the
cheese.
And you dip scallions into the cheese?
You cook them before. You know, saute them in butter, you know, chop them and saute them in butter, and then you mix them with the cheese and serve them in little, you know, phyllo cups or something, you know. Simple,
oh,
easy.
Oh, so it's already cooked in the cheese.
Yeah.
Okay, so you cook them. First, you cook the scallions. They're called spring onions.
Correct.
Spring onions. Yes, correct. And then you cut them up, melt them in cheese, and you could even buy phyllo cups or little pastry cups already made. And you can hand those around.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, that sounds good to me. All right, you've brought some food here. One of my favorite
it's
things in the
a
whole world.
Here.
Yes, tell us what you've brought and why.
Well, we have our chef Sapir, made all the pastries and baked good. Everything is homemade. It's a homemade basket. It's a caramel with pistachio and almonds.
Wait, with the basket isn't
the
is
basket.
Is
it's
made.
Basket.
It's this big basket with of caramel. So wow, that's hard to do because you're working with hot sugars and all.
Yeah.
It's a very fast process. From the moment the sugar gets poured, you have to mold it immediately.
Into the basket. How do you get it out of the basket? How do you get it out of the mold in one piece?
Well, the mold is actually, it goes on top of the mold. So it's just easy to take right off.
Oh, so you turn the mold upside down.
Too.
Exactly. Some almonds and sesames.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And inside we have marble pound cakes, cookies and brownies, and we do our own macaroon. We have an assortment of macaroon.
I had a macaroon that was, of course, I've already eaten most of it. So most of the basket, actually. That was pink, and I thought, oh, maybe this is peppermint. But tell us what it was. It was delicious.
That's actually rose water.
So there's just this wonderful rosy flavor afterwards.
Delicious.
Very light.
It's very clean, very light.
And it's those French macaroons that are so popular now.
And what other kind of macaroons are in there?
Well, we have caramel. We have, I believe, raspberry as well, and salted caramel.
There's cake.
Yes, the
now,
marble
now,
cake.
That marble cake is like so moist, and it just melts in your mouth.
Butter. Butter.
Probably a lot of it, too.
These are delicious.
They really are good. So now, tell me something. Now that everybody's salivating, they really want this basket. Can they order a basket for you, maybe bring as a gift to somebody?
Yeah, we started that about 6 or 8 months ago. We do that for clients, you know, special order. They send, we send them, you know, to our offices or private houses. Yeah.
What a great idea.
It's a gift.
And we also make smaller versions, a mini, in case you want to do like a take-home gift or just use it as like a place setting at a table. So all your guests could actually take a miniature size of that with maybe just macaroons or cookies, but it's a great way to leave your guests with something.
About what would this basket cost?
They're both looking at each other. They don't have no idea.
I don't think it's cheap.
We don't like to talk price.
If you have to ask, you shouldn't then.
Okay, but that's a cute idea, the mini ones for place settings.
For place settings.
Cute. But if you wanted to send a gift to somebody in an office or get well or whatever, that's really a nice idea. They just call up Thierry's Catering?
Absolutely, yeah. Thierry's Catering.
All right. Well, now you're going to be participating in the Bank of America Wine, Spirits, and Culinary Celebration, and that's at the Fort Lauderdale Museum of Discovery and Science. It's going to be tomorrow night, April 4th. And, of course, the proceeds are going to benefit the museum. It's a big gala. Lots of restaurants are going to be there. Lots of wine is going to be there. And you're going to be there. What are you making?
We're going to be there making a nitrogen ice cream. Every year we participate with the organization. We help them coordinate the logistics of it. And this year we're doing the nitrogen ice cream. We're doing 3 flavors, actually.
So tell some people may understand.
That sounds lethal.
The nitrogen is not in the ice cream necessarily. Tell us what it is.
Well, a couple ways of making ice cream. You could churn it, the traditional method. But with that, you do get a lot of air crystallization inside of the ice cream. With the nitrogen, it's just pure creaminess because you're adding this nitrogen liquid, which evaporates eventually, but it just chills the ice cream enough to keep it going and make a delicious product.
But what I think is so fascinating, I mean, people have been doing this for a few years now, and what I think is fascinating about this type of ice cream is you don't make it in advance and have to store it and all. You can make it at the minute, correct, a la minute, because you could, and if somebody came into a restaurant and said, oh, I'd like to have some strawberry ice cream. Actually, I'd like to have some wild strawberry ice cream, come to think of it. It could be made just right away, just for me.
Exactly. Immediately.
Because when you pour this nitrogen liquid in, it just freezes it immediately.
Exactly.
Yes? Did you want to say something?
As long as you have the batter prepared, you know.
You have to have the batter ready.
Yeah.
The base is important, but it brings us to another point. It gives us the freedom to make bases out of almost every flavor or any flavor. So it's a very nice thing.
So what are the 3 flavors you're going to be serving?
One of them is a little alcoholic. We have the blue mojito sorbet, which is wonderful. It's been a hit lately.
Definitely.
Blue mojito? What's
sorbet.
The blue?
Sorbet. Mm-hmm. It's a blue curacao.
Of
that
course.
We use for that. So it's wonderful. Then
now, when you're freezing alcohol, that's a little more difficult to freeze. Does it?
Hence why the nitrogen comes into play.
Yeah.
It's the same.
It's kind of hard to not freeze around nitrogen.
Okay, so then what else are you going to be serving?
We have a cayenne pepper chocolate ice cream that we'll be serving as well.
Cayenne pepper chocolate. Oh, wow.
And I think the last one is a raspberry sorbet.
Correct. Sounds good. But we're going to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Excuse me. We're talking with Thierry Isambert and Peter Key from Thierry's Catering and Event Planning Organization. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more.
The sign-up is over. Now the coverage. Tomorrow on the Florida Roundup, the deadline to get health insurance passes with hundreds of thousands of Floridians signing up. Who's covered? Who isn't? And at what price? Governor Scott's effort to purge voting rolls last year is ruled illegal. The effort to scrub the rolls this year had already been abandoned. And to the economic benefits of large events like last weekend's Ultra and the upcoming Memorial Day Urban Beach Week outweigh public safety concerns? It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup tomorrow at noon.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Whitsam's Nursing Service, committed to offering quality home health care since 1996 by matching patients with caregivers who provide personal care and skilled nursing services. Details at 800-952-3881.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Thierry Isambert. He's the chef owner of Thierry's Catering and Event Planning, and also with Peter Key. He's an event planner for Thierry's. They've been giving us great tips on how to create a wonderful spring party or any kind of party or larger party, and they've delighted us with this wonderful basket full of cookies and cake and all. They're going to be participating tomorrow night, that's April 4th, in the Bank of America Wine, Spirits, and Culinary Celebration at the Fort Lauderdale Museum of Discovery and Science. A great event, and for more information, you can go to mods.org or call the museum. Well, it's dinner in minutes time. So we've had our dessert, which of course should come first, and now we're going to have our dinner. Excuse me. Well, it's seared salmon with an olive tapenade and asparagus fettuccine. This is a spring dish because wild salmon is available now, and this is the best time of year to start having it. And of course, good asparagus from America. U.S. asparagus is delicious. Pan-searing the salmon makes it crisp on the outside and tender and moist inside. And then an olive tapenade, that's a paste made from olives, garlic, olive oil, and herbs. But you don't have to make it. You can go to the store. There are many varieties that are very good. So all you need to do is sear the salmon about 3 minutes, turn it over, cook it another minute, lower the heat for a couple more minutes. That's it. And then put the tapenade on top. Well, and for the fettuccine, I like to buy the fresh fettuccine. You can find it in the supermarket, and the asparagus. And so they can both cook together, all in one pot, in about 3 to 4 minutes. That's it. Drain it, toss it with olive oil and salt and pepper. That's a 15-minute spring meal.
Did you say to, when you were talking about the asparagus right. you put in with the fettuccine, you're
yes.
saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, cut it up into smaller pieces or leave it whole, and then and just serve it up with olive oil and salt and pepper. Very easy. That whole recipe and a photograph, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please, follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. And Fred, spring wines?
Well, Linda always tries to put me in an impossible wine pairing positions, and this is no exception.
Only she with wants- love, Fred. Only with love.
Only with love, yeah. But wines for spring entertaining, she says. Well, I Googled what wines are in season, what foods are in season now, and the most popular early veggie is the one you have in your recipe, asparagus. But asparagus is a real problem for wine lovers. For starters, it's infamous for containing components that impart a bad odor to your urine. Did you know that?
Oh, this is a very happy
Thanks
topic.
Thanks for reminding
Thank
us.
Now, I'm not sure in what social occasions that comes up, but apparently it's a major awkward moment for a lot of people. And what's worse is that same asparagus compound, which is called organosulfur carboxylic acid, makes wines taste metallic. So you got a double whammy there. And you can Google 100 blog items about this, so it's really hard to get a good food-wine pairing with that. So you say, helpfully, maybe we could switch to artichokes. Nope, they have their own compound. It makes wine taste too sweet. And every other veggie, cabbage, lettuce, cauliflower, celery, all the spring vegetables have problems that make good wine matches difficult.
So are you telling us we can't have our veggies?
Yep, you got to give up vegetables to go with wine.
Oh, my goodness, Fred.
No, actually, the best solution is don't eat the offending vegetables by themselves. Hide them in casseroles smothered with cheese or in soup masked by garlic and potatoes and things like that. And if you must eat these veggies by themselves, for heaven's sake, don't pair them with tannic red wines. That'll make it tannic and metallic at the same time. So here are some last-ditch recommendations for these vegetables. And they also happen to be light and lively wines that are very nice for celebrating spring. you could try. You want light, youthful, citrusy, relatively low alcohol wines like Riesling or unoaked Chardonnay or a nice herbal New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Or even better, you can get brave and try a Grüner Veltliner. This is light and lively, and there's actually a cult following around it. It's an Austrian wine that friends affectionately call Grüner, and they spell it G-R-O-O-N-E-R.
Is that available locally and all?
In big wine shops, you'll find it.
I think that means Greenfield.
Really? Well, yeah. That makes sense with a nice green wine. Anyway, it'll make you seem hip, if nothing else. Or failing that, now I'm living in Michigan now, in your last resort, you can Google the Fox Barn Winery in Shelby, Michigan, and you can buy on the internet a very tasty asparagus wine.
Wine made from asparagus?
That's right, yeah. Ooh. They make wine out of everything these days. And okay. Failing even that, just try to hang in till Easter, because the required food for Easter is lamb, and boy, there are 100 wines that go well with that, so I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. I have to tell everybody the joke that Fred sent to me, because when he talked about the asparagus, and I mentioned to him I have asparagus in the recipe, and he said, well, you can drink milk.
That's a great wine pairing, or not wine pairing, great beverage pairing.
Milk and asparagus?
Milk and asparagus, according to Fred Tasker.
All the 3-year-olds on the planet do that.
All right. Well, let's get back to our caterers here, Thierry and Peter. And there are a lot of questions people keep asking me about caterers and how do you approach them and that kind of thing. And one point we were discussing before the show with you, and Thierry, you said this is a very important point to notice. What about giving a final number count? Should we understate the numbers, knowing that some people won't show up? Is there a rule of thumb? What should we do when we're giving a final count to a caterer?
Well, I think the best way for the guest is to give a lower count.
Now, that's coming from a caterer.
Yes.
Because people say, oh, is
that
honest?
Instead of going to a higher count, give us a lower count. So you are based on a lower count. And 5 working days prior to the event.
4 working days.
Yeah, 5 working days. You can always increase the count. It's better than to be stuck with a high count and 20 people or whatever, 20% doesn't show up. And that happened. And you get stuck paying the bill for the missing guests.
What about people that overstay themselves? And how do you get them to gracefully leave?
You could always turn off the lights.
When push comes to shove, you could always turn off the lights.
They start folding up the chairs and tables.
Exactly. Isn't it time to serve coffee then? Does that kind of announce that it's time to get the heck out of there?
In some cases, it keeps them going.
Right.
Wakes them up, huh?
Do you do smaller parties as well?
Yeah, we do a small dinner party. 10 people, 3-4 course sit down. Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. We do a lot of gift certificates for charities, different organizations. We do about, for silent auction, we give them those gift certificates, and we have about 15 charities, organizations that we do those every year.
Okay. And so we only have a half a minute left, but another question I get asked all the time are tips for staffs. Now, you get a percentage is added to your bill, gratuity, and tax. Should you give something to the staff extra?
By all means. We leave it to the discretion of the client, but we do ask for gratuities, and the staff, if they provide a good service, by all means, they should receive some.
Give me a ballpark.
Depending on the service, anywhere from $25 to $50 is more than apt for a staff member.
And Terry, you said people sometimes call you and ask, should they, or... Yeah. What you really need to do is depend on your caterer and ask them for advice on things.
Well, there's sometimes advice, but the tips, Peter just answer, an average of $50,
That's what we should do. Well, this is all great advice. I have a million more questions to ask you, but we're out of time. It's really, really a tasty week. This dessert basket is superb. Thierry Isambert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Linda.
And Peter Kay, thank you.
Our
Peter
pleasure.
Key, sorry.
Peter Key, thank you
thank
for
you
having
very
us.
Much. And of course, many thanks for the food. Go to Thierry Catering, that's Thierry catering.com, or you can call them at 305-635-6626 for more information or for that wonderful basket. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Cooper, Bonnie Berman, great to be with you.
Likewise.
Next week, we're going to be talking with Haven Restaurant chef owner Todd Erickson about new restaurant trends. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening in. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, photos, discussion, and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. We return Monday with an At Your Service edition on how adults can best care for elderly parents or friends. There are some 42 million caregivers in the United States. And to the calendar, on this day in 1905, 109 years ago, new Florida Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward gives his inaugural address and lays out the plans for drainage of the Everglades. Later in the year, the legislature passed drainage laws. The New River was the first dredge site. And on this day in 1924, 90 years ago, the birth of actor Marlon Brando in Omaha, Nebraska. His mother actually helped begin the career of Henry Fonda. One more before we sing I'm Walkin'. On this day in 1930, 84 years ago, the birth of Florida's U.S. Senator and Governor Lawton Childs in Lakeland. In his 1970 Senate campaign, he trod from Pensacola to Key West. So we leave with a thought from Marlon Brando, whose first screen role was the bitter, crippled veteran in 1950's The Men. Quote from Brando, "Acting is the expression of a neurotic impulse. It's a bum's life. The principal benefit acting has afforded me is the money to pay for my psychoanalysis." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.
In just a few moments, here in